It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There is an increasing interest among white college students to better understand the evolution of black politics 40, 50 years ago. That's according to Dr. Leonard Moore, a Cleveland native and the Vice President for Diversity and Community Engagement, as well as the George Littlefield Professor of American History at the University of Texas at Austin. Leonard Moore will be the keynote speaker at the Heinz History Center's Black History Month lecture later this month. He joined the Confluence's Megan Harris from his office in Austin, Texas.
Dr. Moore, your keynote here in Pittsburgh will focus on black power and black politics through the civil rights and power movements in the 60s and 70s. What about that period speaks to you?
I don't know. I think it was an exciting time in America. I think America was changing. But I think what we see during that period from 1904 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and then 1972 with Nixon's election, I think you see in that 18-year period, I think you see the black freedom movement make the shift from protest to politics.
How do you think history has treated black pride, you know, the building of black institutions and black solidarity?
I don't know, I think a lot of people take it for granted now, but, you know, we have to remind people that, you know, before the civil rights movement and then the black power movement, you know, there wasn't, you know, black people were taught that being black was bad, you know, taught that we were unattractive, taught that, you know, we hadn't made any contributions of value to the country. So I think this idea of beginning to love oneself, beginning to love our hair, the way we look, our skin color, and more importantly, beginning to, you know, to appreciate our culture and our customs. I think that was a very pivotal period. I mean, there was once a time in the black community where if you called somebody black, they would get offended, you know, but now most of us, we know, wear it as a badge of honor instead of a badge of shame.
Do you think as a society, you know, in the modern context, that we're doing enough to protect black pride?
I don't know. I think so. I think, you know, we live in very interesting political times. But I told my students back this last semester that typically when we realize we don't have a friend in the White House, that's when you see the black community pull together a little bit more. In that many ways was the strategy during Jim Crow, where although we couldn't vote, although we're dealing with lynching and convict leasing and a whole host of other ills, you know, you had very strong and very vibrant black communities because they were self-reliant. You know, they had to be self-reliant to exist.
You mentioned your students. You've been really applauded for your teaching style. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I don't know. I love it. You know, and I, you know, the first day of class, I give some ground rules. I tell them, number one, I'm not politically correct. Number two, you can't get offended. And number three, I tell them we're going to have fun. I think what I try to do when I teach, I don't go in with an agenda trying to get students to adopt a particular point of view. I don't use the term social justice because I think that term is relative depending on one's viewpoint. But I tell people, I believe a mature American is one who appreciates other people's viewpoints and experiences, although they may not agree with them.
I was about to say, from everything I've read about your classrooms, you're really blunt, you don't sugarcoat. Do you think that bluntness is missing in a lot of classrooms, especially in how we talk about race?
I do, and I think, you know, some of us who consider ourselves social justice activists, you know, we are guilty for that. You know, I think we don't allow children to have tough conversations anymore. I think we've allowed many of our students to become easily offended. I was speaking to a group of 100 students last night here at the University of Texas campus, and one student was talking about he didn't find some environment inclusive enough, or he felt like they didn't like him because of his race. I said, give people permission not to like you. And I understand some people may not like me because of my race, my gender, my sexuality, whatever, you know, but I think too often we have given students this idea that everybody must accept you. And unfortunately, that's just not how life works. And so what I try to tell students, I try to build resilience in students. You know what I mean? That you may go into an environment where they may not appreciate everything you bring to the table, but you don't let that hold you back.
You've written a lot in the past about how your class has changed from nearly 80% black in the early years to now, on occasion, 550 very racially and socioeconomically diverse young adults, faculty, community members auditing the class. How did that happen, that openness?
I found that ethnic studies course, I teach courses on black politics, courses on the black power movement, a class in called Race in the Age of Trump. Here's what I found. White kids want this stuff. They want it. They're intrigued by it because it's never been presented to them before. And I tell people all the time, when I think about black studies departments and Mexican American studies departments, I really believe it is the white students who benefit the most, because these classes help white students learn about other cultures. And what I tell some of my white students, even some of my conservative white kids who want to go straight to Wall Street when they graduate, you may not like Black Lives Matter. You may not understand it. You may think it's foolish, but your boss may have a Black Lives Matter sticker on her desk. So you better learn how to deal with people from all backgrounds. And they, when I put it like that, they tend to accept it.
You mentioned your course, Race in the Age of Trump. What does a syllabus for a class like that look like?
That's a class where you actually don't have to do a lot of prep work, because my president, our president, gives me fresh course material every single day. But, you know, we just deal with a lot. We just deal with a lot of the hot button issues. You know, we deal with race and admissions. We deal with police brutality. We'll talk about immigration. We just deal with a lot of the hot button issues, and looking at it in many ways through this, you know, this contemporary movement that Donald Trump has created.
Well, looking back a little bit, that same class, Race in the Age of Trump, used to be called Race in the Age of Obama. I'm curious, aren't they the same era? Why was it important to change the name?
And here's what I remind people. You know, people were very, very critical of Trump getting elected. I said, what we have to remember is that we had a Black family in the White House for 8 years. You know, and there was a whole lot of people, a whole lot of white people voted for Obama, you know, in 2008 and then again in 2012. But I think the Obamas represented hope and optimism to a certain degree. And I think the Trump presidency represents sort of this counter-revolution. So I think we are in a totally different political moment.
Does that mean it's changed the tone of your class as well?
Little bit. And, you know, and I try to be even keeled in my assessment of the president. And again, I tell people my goal is not to make you a Democrat or Republican. We just want to deal with the material from an intellectual point of view. As a politician, Trump is brilliant. And students get offended when I say that, you know, just strictly you take his politics out of it. And one thing I appreciated President Trump said, he said, if you don't like what I'm doing, you can vote me out in 4 years. How refreshing would it be if every politician had that same model?
I wonder, Texas, of course, tends to be overwhelmingly conservative, and like a lot of the South, has its own attitudes about what it makes of its past and present wrongs. Does that affect the coursework or your teaching at all?
Not really. And I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and I tell people all the time, I really believe that my personality is suited to the politics in the Deep South. And let me explain to you what I mean. We have a lot of folk in the Northeast and the Midwest who call themselves liberal, but often they are liberal about trees, bicycles, emissions, and things of that nature. But what I like about dealing with white Southerners, can I just be honest?
Absolutely.
They are just honest and straight up. And I was speaking to a group of retirees, white retirees in suburban, a wealthy community in Austin. And I gave a lecture, and some men walked out even before I said anything when they saw the subject matter. But I remember during the question and answer, one man asked me about Black Lives Matter. And we had a little bit of a dialogue, and here's his quote. He said, well, Dr. Moore, if you all would just obey the police, you wouldn't get shot. Now, let me tell you why I didn't get offended. Because he was being honest. That was his unfiltered self. And what I find with white Southerners, the conversations we can have here in Texas are a lot more frank. They are a lot more transparent than I could have any conversation with a liberal in Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., or Cleveland, Ohio.
When you're pulling from history, some of the personalities of that era still loom so larger than life. Dr. Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, so many others. And those young men specifically were killed. So in a way, sometimes they feel kind of locked into a moment. Do you feel like as a country we do justice, not just to their biographies, but to the policies and ideals they tried to champion?
I don't know. You know, we don't look at often how people evolve. You know, and I tell a lot of my activist students, you know, they Malcolm X is seen as sort of like the patron saint of all this. But we forget that, you know, Malcolm made another transition, 64, 65, when he embraces Orthodox Islam. You know what I mean? But everybody wants to remember Malcolm from the Nation of Islam. And while that episode of his life was truly impactful, we may do him a disservice, you know, if we don't start referring to him as, you know, El Haj Malik El Shabazz. So that's the way I look at that.
So how would you say Malcolm X compares to the names of young Black men today? many of them involuntarily influencing our politics. I'm thinking of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Laquan McDonald, and even here in Pittsburgh, Antoine Rose Jr.
Every movement has its icons, you know what I mean? And I think, you know, you mentioned some other icons from the 60s. But when I think about Trayvon Martin and others, I think those will represent in many ways important timelines, you know what I mean? These important pivotal events that I believe every generation remembers. Sort of like my parents' generation, you know, remembering when Emmett Till, you know, got killed and seeing his picture in Jet magazine. I think every African-American parent remembers where they were when George Zimmerman got off for killing Trayvon Martin. Me and my family, we were in a hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, and I remember it vividly.
What do you say to your community, to your activist students in moments like that?
I don't know. First thing I tell them is that activism is a marathon and not a sprint. That's number one. They want things to change quickly. And I said, unfortunately, things don't work like that. But I also tell them that, you know, you have to be sincere about activism. You can't do this because you want a platform or because you want publicity or some degree of community power. It has to be in you. And you really find out over time who is sincere about it.
Do you feel a sense of ownership putting events of the present in context with really horrible tragedies and challenges and successes of the past?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done enough of a job telling the story. One of the major tenets of the Black Power movement, you know, they had these special schools that popped up on Saturdays oftentimes, you know, really teaching a lot about African-American history, life, politics, and culture. And someone like me, having grown up in a half-Black, half-Orthodox Jewish community in Cleveland, Ohio, you know, a lot of my Jewish friends, they went to Hebrew school on the weekends where they understood the Jewish history and the Jewish traditions, and they understood what was expected of them as Jewish men and women. So we have gotten away from some of that, particularly when you consider, think about Black flight to the suburbs. You know, we're not as concentrated as we once were, but that is definitely something that we've lost.
What do you think cities like Pittsburgh can do for its K-12 and college students to better prepare them? Make them more mindful, more conscious, better than us.
Mm-hmm. Here's what I'll say. I've never understood why some school districts have what they call a gifted and talented program. And I know AP courses, that's a national piece. My thing is, give everybody the same curriculum. I am convinced that inner city kids, particularly, if you show them what the bar is, they will meet it. And I've been arguing for the longest that I think a lot of inner city kids, they're a little bit more mature than their wealthier counterparts. I'm talking about kids 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But I think sometimes when they come to school, the curriculum is not engaging. You know, imagine a kid 8 years old who has to babysit her younger brother and her younger sister, who's changing diapers, who's cooking. But when that kid comes to school, the curriculum is not fun. It is not engaging. It is not stimulating. So what I would say, let's find the most elite school, private school in Pittsburgh. Let's take that same curriculum and let's put it in the inner city. And I guarantee you will see change.
Dr. Leonard Moore is the Vice President for Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the keynote speaker at Heinz History Center's Black History Month lecture, February 28th. Dr. Moore, thanks so much for talking to us, and safe travels to Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the iconic all-female Motown group The Supremes perform at Civic Arena in 1967. The musicians drew a crowd of more than 12,000, among the highest the facility ever held. The group had just had multiple number one hits, including Baby Love, Back in My Arms Again, Come See About Me, and Stop in the Name of Love. Their 1967 appearance wasn't their first in the Steel City. They'd performed 3 years earlier at the Syria Mosque in Oakland. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, we meet historian and cultural anthropologist Shaquie Edward Carter, founder of the Greater Hazelwood Historical Society. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports on the efforts to preserve the neighborhood's history.
The Greater Hazelwood Historical Society of Pittsburgh was founded in 2018 to restore neighborhood pride and preserve the pillars of our community's past.
Jaquay Edward Carter says he started the Historical Society with a vision to keep Hazelwood's early days alive by compiling old images and speaking with residents who have lived and experienced the neighborhood's changes. Like many areas in Pittsburgh, renovations and major structural changes are taking place. In fact, Hazelwood is where the city's last active steel mill was located. Carter says part of his vision for spearheading the movement of preservation was to uphold the essence of the area.
It was actually founded at a time when the focus on the community's development was the future without any regard to the historic preservation of the buildings and places and spaces that were beloved by many members of the community.
He also says it is imperative to continue the rich traditions of the neighborhood by bridging the gap between generations.
I'm on the phone with a lot of older people all the time, talking to them as mentors and confidants. So I'm going to impart that wisdom on to the youth.
He stresses that for the area's youth, having a grasp of Hazelwood's past is essential for shaping the neighborhood's future.
They actually are going to be the next generation to change the world, so they have to know what happened before them to fully understand how to go into the future.
And Carter says the neighborhood's history is rich, from its role in the steel industry to the little-known fact that a game created by Hugh J. Ward that spread worldwide originated right here in Hazelwood.
The game of bingo was created here in Hazelwood in the 1920s and went on to be worldwide famous, and actually was able to find records to support all of those things, you know, where he lived at the time when the game was invented. He copyrighted the game. Even the house where he died in the 1940s is still there.
I have a newfound respect and appreciation for the history of Hazelwood.
Devin Igles, a senior at South Allegheny High School, is a Hazelwood native.
Now every time I go through Hazelwood, it's just, I look at it like it's a whole new place. Like down on the main road, there were more like buildings, and he really taught me about the history and about the community of Hazelwood and how I can help.
Historical Society board member Marianne McHarg says she and longtime residents are excited about the growth and development of the organization.
This is really what's going to be there to tell the narrative of Hazelwood, what I'd like to call the integrity of the neighborhood. I think that it's important, not just in the sense of preserving what is good, but also preserving the trials and the tribulations and the resilience of the people.
Although there is no physical space for the Hazelwood Historical Society at the moment, the renovation of the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's Hazelwood branch, built in 1899 and condemned for over 15 years, will serve as the offices, coupled with a museum filled with artifacts for people to visit. I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
Pennsylvania's minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour for a decade. That's the lowest level allowed by the federal government. During that time, over the past decade, the cost of food, gas, and just about everything else has risen. While workers in Pennsylvania have waited, the minimum wage has increased in 29 other states, including every single one of our neighboring states.
That's Governor Tom Wolf unveiling his latest proposal to boost the minimum wage in Pennsylvania to $12 an hour, followed by annual increases till the minimum reaches $15 an hour in 2025. This is the fifth straight year the governor's called for an increase in the minimum wage. The first four efforts failed. We're going to talk about the perceived merits and drawbacks of boosting the wage. With us in studio are Anthony Davies, Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University, Mark Bucklaw, President of the Southside Chamber of Commerce, and Sam Williamson is the District Director for 32BJ Service Employees International Union. And joining us from Harrisburg is Mark Price, economist with the Keystone Research Center. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
That comment we just heard from the governor, 29 other states raising their minimum wage. Every one of Pennsylvania's neighboring states has a higher minimum wage than Pennsylvania's, which is $7.25 an hour. Our neighbors range from $8.55 an hour in Ohio to $11.10 in New York. So should Pennsylvania follow suit? Mark, you're on the line from Harrisburg. We'll start with you and then get the other thoughts of our other guests.
Absolutely. I think, you know, our chief concern is that the value of the minimum wage has been eroded over time in terms of its purchasing power. And low-wage workers in particular lack a lot of bargaining power, so that their wages don't grow as fast, even as the economy improves, unemployment rates fall, and productivity and profitability improve, their wages don't. So I think minimum wage, we see it as a way to boost wage growth for low-wage workers and really, you know, improve their quality of life. Because, again, you know, the cost of transportation, the cost of housing, everything has increased, you know, on average around 20% since the last increase in the minimum wage. So I think it's long past time for Pennsylvania to move forward with a minimum wage increase.
Anthony.
Well, I think there's a bit of a bait and switch going on with minimum wage. The minimum wage isn't $7.25 an hour or $12 an hour or whatever else it is. The minimum wage is zero. That's the wage that the worker earns when his job disappears because it isn't worth it to the employer to maintain the worker anymore. So really, I think we look at the minimum wage as if it were a restriction on employers, telling employers you must pay X. In fact, it's a restriction on workers. It says to workers, if you can't find someone willing to pay you $7.25 an hour, you may not work at all.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that you make there with that. And one thing that if there is a increase in wages on the small business level, they're going to have to be a little bit more creative with how they manage the ins and outs of their business. This could mean less store hours. Maybe the owner or the manager takes on more of a role within the company because this is now another expense, right? There's an expense line item that goes up, and that's wages. So it could have an effect on a lot of small businesses. Maybe they start to look at other opportunities with e-commerce or how they go about creating and generating their revenue. But it could hurt that job opportunity where people are not going to hire as many people. And that could also hurt expansion, you know, because expansion in companies creates more jobs. That's more opportunities for workers.
Sam Williamson.
Look, the reality is that no one in Pennsylvania or in America, for that matter, can live off of $7.25 an hour. It's simply not enough to allow a single person, let alone a family, to enough money to support themselves. The vast majority of people earning the minimum wage or less than the $12 an hour that Governor Wolf wants to raise it to in Pennsylvania are adults working full-time who are trying to support themselves or their families. And if we don't raise the minimum wage, we are essentially saying as a society that we don't believe that employers should have to pay enough to allow people to pay their bills and cover the basic cost of living. We have a minimum wage in the first place in America because workers fought for it, because workers organized and fought to make sure that we have the basic safeguards in our economy and in the workplace that we need to keep workers safe, to work 40 hours a week, to have enough wages to support ourselves. And when we don't raise the minimum wage to actually keep pace with the cost of living, we are creating an even more imbalanced economy than we already have.
Right. We heard Mark Bucklaw say that employers might go to alternatives, cut hours or take other steps. But is there any evidence that small businesses in neighboring Maryland, New Jersey, Delaware, West Virginia, just some of our neighbors that have higher minimum wages than Pennsylvania, is there any evidence that the small businesses in those states have been hurt by having the higher minimum than Pennsylvania does? Mark, we'll start with you. Mark.
It's hard to kind of track something like that because, I mean, you think about the uniqueness of a lot of small businesses. It's really what type of product or service are they providing? Even thinking about somebody who's maybe even running a lawn care business. Right. If they have to up the cost of, you know, trimming the grass, maybe that person goes out and does it themselves. I mean, that's a very small business idea. But, you know, if somebody doesn't want to run a storefront anymore because they see there's more value in not having to pay higher wages, but rather listing things on the Internet and trying to go that route. So I think there's such a broad spectrum of small companies that it's hard to put together a pool to see who exactly are these minimum wage earners. Are they the younger population? Are we going to lose out on jobs for people, you know, under the age of 25? Do they make up most of that capacity? So it's kind of a hard question to answer with, you know, just a sample size of not every company looks the same that's a small business.
Anthony.
And you can see evidence of this when you look around. Once upon a time, when you went into a McDonald's and ordered a Coke, they gave you a Coke. And for a long time now, they've handed you a cup and pointed to a machine, and you go and do it yourself. And now we see McDonald's, other fast food restaurants introducing kiosks. And part of what's driving this is the fact that as labor becomes ever more expensive, it becomes relatively cheaper to replace those workers with machines. And so these jobs just simply disappear.
Sam?
So we do actually have some of those numbers. In Pennsylvania, 10% of minimum wage earners are teenagers, only 10%. That means 90% of minimum wage earners in Pennsylvania are adults trying to support themselves and their families and to live off of $15,000 a year. Frankly, workers have always dealt with technological advances. Since the Industrial Revolution, workers have dealt with bosses and huge corporations trying to come up with more efficient ways to get work done and put them out of work. It's not raising wages that creates that trend, frankly, and it's worker organizing that will keep up with that and continue to create economic opportunities for working people in Pennsylvania and across the country.
Mark Price, does the Keystone Research Center look at other states as well and the potential impact of minimum wage on the small businesses?
We haven't looked particularly at small businesses, and I think as Mark from the Chamber noted, I mean, one of the challenges there is getting access to data. So we have taken a look at trends in employment in food services and drinking places. And I think here, before I get into that, I just want to explain that there's a lot of very good econometric work by academic researchers from all across the country that finds in other states, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, New York, all of our neighboring states, when they've raised the minimum wage, they have not observed a reduction in employment, but they have observed an increase in wages. Now, there's some disagreement among economists. There's some still that use different research methods and come to a slightly different conclusion. But by and large, the research evidence is that you don't see the kinds of broad reductions in employment, at least, that folks sometimes worry about. And I think looking across the region in a very simple way, in employment and food services and drinking places, in New York State, employment's growing faster in that sector, and that's in a sector that employs a lot of low-wage workers. Employment's growing faster there than it is in Pennsylvania, where the minimum wage has remained $7.25, and wages are actually also growing. So I think it illustrates very clearly that you often hear a lot of rhetoric about, you know, a minimum wage increase is going to lead to catastrophic changes in the broader economy, and it's pretty clear that the debates among economists are about relatively small effects, and even at their worst, and when you look again at our region, we haven't seen the kind of job loss that folks worry about. What we have seen, though, is that wages rise, and I think that's probably the most important piece of evidence to think about.
Sam, are you concerned that some of the people you advocate for could lose their jobs if small businesses either have to cut back or go with more technology that basically replaces some workers?
I mean, I'm concerned that the workers, our members who make less than $12 an hour, or the fast food workers who I've stood on the picket line with, are struggling to pay their rent and struggling to live in Pittsburgh, live in Pennsylvania anymore. I think we will have to deal as a society with the continuing changes in the workplace due to technological advances and increased mechanization and the advance of robots and all of that. I think that's a separate issue and a separate question that we're going to have to tackle as an economy and as workers, no matter what. You know, what's before us today is the question of whether people can actually live off of $15,000 a year, and they simply cannot. Having low wages and keeping people in poverty is bad for our economy. It's bad for the health of our citizens. It's bad for our state. And frankly, we wouldn't let small businesses pollute our rivers or pollute our air or do anything else that is bad for the broader health of our community. And we shouldn't let them pay low wages either.
You're listening to The Confluence, so we're talking about the governor's latest proposal to increase Pennsylvania's minimum wage. That conversation continues in just a moment on 90.5 WESA. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about how workers, business owners, and our Commonwealth's economy might be affected if Pennsylvania raises its minimum wage. Still with us are Duquesne economics professor Anthony Davies, Mark Bucklaw of the Southside Chamber of Commerce, Sam Williamson, who represents 32BJ with the SEIU, and by phone, economist Mark Price with the Keystone Research Center. So a reminder, our current minimum is $7.25 an hour. The governor's proposed raising that to $12 an hour with steady increases up to $15 an hour by 2025. Briefly, let's back up a little bit. Who in Pennsylvania is making minimum wage, whether it's by socioeconomic breakdown, by race? Is there a disparity in that? Who wants to start off with that? All right, Anthony.
In Pennsylvania, I could tell you it's about 1% of workers earn the minimum wage, 1%. And so this goes back to Mark Price's comment about studies showing that raising the minimum wage does not increase unemployment. And that's true. There are many studies that show that. And part of the problem there is minimum wage workers comprise such a small fraction of the workforce that if you look at the effect on unemployment, the effect on minimum wage workers gets drowned out. But if you pull them out and ask what happens to unemployment amongst the least skilled, least educated, least experienced workers, there you start to see the serious effect. So what the minimum wage is really doing is knocking the most marginal workers out of the workforce and replacing them with higher skilled workers.
Gentlemen, Anthony just said 1%, but this would raise people who are currently making $8, $9, $10, $11, whatever, up to that $12 level. So it's going to affect a lot more people than 1% of the workforce, is it not, Sam?
Yes, absolutely. And they are disproportionately people of color, disproportionately women, and, you know, and not just fast food workers. We think of fast food workers because fast food workers have courageously led the struggle and the fight for 15 all across America. But, you know, we're also talking about bank tellers and home health care aides and, you know, workers in the hospitality industry, cleaners, security officers, folks all across our economy who do vital, frankly, work to, you know, to keep us safe and to keep us healthy and are simply not making enough to survive.
Mark, any other categories of workers, businesses that are making the minimum or even up to $12 an hour, the folks that you represent with the Southside Chamber?
I think a lot of those people are some of the first people that you see when you walk into a store or a business. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of that first point of contact, which also kind of shows that there's that's a pretty strong position to hold. So, you know, when you walk into either a retail store or a restaurant establishment or something like that, usually those lower wage workers are some of the first people that you see. And if they're happy and content in their job, that usually reflects their attitude towards where they're at currently and towards you coming in as a patron. You know, so I think that there's opportunities to help those people. But, you know, we really should be careful as to we don't want to eliminate their opportunity to work by drastically changing a minimum increase.
Are all minimum wage jobs meant to be entry level?
Can I say something about this notion that all minimum wage jobs are entry-level jobs or that, frankly, entry-level jobs ought to be low-paying jobs? You know, steel workers' jobs at one point were the least skilled, lowest-paying jobs in America. Every manufacturing job in the early 20th century was a low-paying, dangerous job. They only became something that could build the middle class when workers organized and fought for the basic protections, including raising the minimum wage, that allowed them to turn them into decent middle-class jobs. So there's nothing intrinsic in the nature of a fast food job or a bank teller job or a retail job that ought to make it low-paying. Every job ought to pay enough to allow someone to work 40 hours a week and support themselves and their families.
Is it a level...
And if I could add to that...
Go ahead,
if
Mark.
If I could add to that, I think it's important also to note that back in 1968, the minimum wage was $1.60 an hour. The median wage for full-time, full-year workers was $3.15 an hour. So basically, what we're calling the entry-level wage was about 50% of what the middle-class sort of worker would earn. Fast forward today, the minimum wage is $7.25, and we estimate this year that the median wage for full-time, full-year workers in Pennsylvania will be $24.44 an hour. So basically, the minimum wage now is about 30% of the value of a middle-class wage. And that I think follows up nicely on Sam's point that part of the reason we are having this discussion about raising the minimum wage is because we've allowed it to fall over time. And that has had the effect of not only reducing sort of entry-level wages for folks right at $7.25, but it's operated as downward pressure on the growth in wages for a broad group of workers in the bottom 10, 20%. So I think it's very important to remember that we are having this debate precisely because the minimum wage has less purchasing power than it used to.
All right. So the question is, Anthony and Mark, are you opposed to any increase in the minimum, or is it the amount the governor is proposing?
I'm opposed to any increase, and I'm opposed to it because I think we get the causality backward. The wage rate is not something that sets the value of labor so that we could just turn it like a knob and now labor is more valuable. It's the other way around. The value of the labor is reflected in the wage rate. If we have a problem that people aren't earning enough to be able to support themselves and their families, the answer isn't to legislatively adjust the wage rate. The answer is to make their labor more valuable. And that means giving them access to attain better skills, better education, better job experience. And raising the minimum wage actually stands in the way of that. It doesn't promote it.
Mark Bucklaw.
No, I think that's a great point to make. I'm kind of an in-betweener. You know, I'd like to see other people. I'd like to see people earn more money. I'd hate to see people being mistreated. And if the minimum wage is a tool that people can utilize to underpay a worker, you don't want to see that happen. But on the other side of things is like I see the points that we're making about advancing in people's education and skills to drive up the workforce. I think it's a very positive thing.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to get to a couple more questions. So, Sam, would you support a smaller jump, maybe to $10, and then annual increases?
I support the governor's proposal. I support raising the minimum wage immediately to $12 an hour and getting it to 15 over time. I think it's critical that we index it to inflation. And I also think there's another aspect of the governor's proposal that we haven't talked about yet, which is allowing cities to set their own minimum wage. In Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh is not allowed to have a higher minimum wage than that which is set by the state. So city council and the mayor are hamstrung in their abilities to actually improve the lives of working people here in Pittsburgh.
Well, let me follow up quickly with Mark Bucklaw and Anthony. What about local entities having the authority to institute their own minimums?
Yeah, I'm all for that. I think it's a great idea because it will underline what economists have been saying, that raising the minimum wage is going to destroy jobs. So let the cities do this and we can observe what happens.
All right. Mark?
Yeah, I second that.
All right. So very briefly, what's your take on what the governor said, that this will actually reduce the demand on state and federal services and therefore save money, very briefly?
Well, it will reduce demand by people who actually keep their jobs. For people who lose their jobs, it's going to increase demand on government services.
All right. In our last minute, quick thoughts on, all right, I mentioned this is the fifth time the governor is proposing an increase in 5 years. What are the chances of passage? Briefly, Mark Price, we'll start with you.
The chances for passage, you know, again, it's a tough call because it's a General Assembly that is dominated by Republicans. And they did, back in 2006, Republican majorities in both the House and Senate endorsed an increase in the minimum wage from $5.15 to $7.10. So I think it's within the realm of possibilities, but it remains a question of whether the leadership of the Republican caucus in both the House and Senate are willing to allow a vote to happen. If they allow a vote to happen, I think absolutely we could see a minimum wage increase this year.
Sam Williamson.
I agree. I think the momentum is growing. Pressure is increasing on Harrisburg to act. And if you care about working people out there, pick up the phone and call your state legislator.
Mark Bucklaw.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. We're 5 years into this. You know, is it going to be 5 years from now and we're still having the same conversation about it? The other thing I kind of worry about is what is it going to be then if that's the case? Is it now going to be $15 an hour, right? So I think that if we are going to make a move to progress the minimum wage, that we should do it slowly and it should happen sooner rather than later.
All right. Thanks to all of our guests. That was Mark Bucklaw, president of the Southside Chamber of Commerce, Anthony Davies, associate professor of economics at Duquesne University, Sam Williamson, district director for 32BJ Service Employees International Union, and Mark Price, economist with the Keystone Research Center. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.